Thanks. Thank you all for coming out. Thanks for that kind introduction, Alex, and thanks to ACSI for the opportunity to be here in Melbourne this morning to speak to you. A lot has happened in financial markets globally and in Australia since late last year. I thought this morning it would be helpful to summarize the key developments, including revisions to the global outlook, concerns about some of the downside risks, and changes to market expectations for monetary policy paths. I'd also like to discuss their implications for the Australian economy and the Australian dollar. But just let me first start with a caveat. I think that's in order on the topic of exchange rates. So it's often said by Reserve Bank staff, myself included, that we're not in the business of forecasting exchange rates. But just as importantly, we also need to be humble, we, the Reserve Bank, when explaining the past behaviour of exchange rates. I think in that regard, it's worth recognising that the models that we do have of exchange rates provide only rough estimates of the more enduring relationships. So let's talk a bit about the international backdrop. So after a lengthy period of relative stability, global financial markets have been more volatile over the past few months. The incoming data from around the end of 2018 was associated with a tightening in financial conditions. Global equity prices declined, corporate credit spreads widened, issuance of corporate debt eased, and volatility picked up across most markets. And in the space of only a couple of months, the market's expectations for monetary policies changed markedly, and there was a notable downward shift in yield curves. So what prompted all of these changes? Well, in part, market participants reassessed their expectations for global growth. This reflected a run of data that was a bit weaker than had earlier been expected, particularly for the industrial sector and the trade sector. However, it was not true of all incoming data. Indeed, labour markets remained in good health, and the US labour market data of late have been especially strong. Moreover, labour market tightness is evident more broadly, and wages growth is picking up in a range of advanced economies. So this chart uses IMF forecasts for GDP growth, and you can see their forecast for the world economy, and also with pulled all the separate parts apart and put them together to show you Australia's major trading partners' forecasts as implied by the IMF forecast for each of those economies. So forecasts for Australia's trading partners have been revised lower, but only marginally. And in late January, the IMF forecast for global growth were trimmed for 2019 and 2020, as you can see here, but by 0.2 and 0.1 percentage points respectively. Growth of Australia's major trading partners is expected to decline slightly in 2019 to around its historical average. It's also worth noting that at least some of this moderation in growth has been by design. So over the past year or more, policymakers in both China and the US, for instance, have sought to ensure that growth in their economies was placed on a more sustainable footing. But that's a story of what is about what is most likely to happen. In other words, the central tendency of the distribution of possible outcomes. But much of what the market reaction of late has been prompted by greater concern about the potential for adverse but less likely outcomes, the so-called downside risks. From Australia's standpoint, at the top of the list of risks is the outlook for our largest trading partner, China. One concern relates to the extent and nature of leverage in China. The Chinese authorities had earlier moved to contain the growth in leverage, particularly where it was funded by using so-called shadow financing channels. And while that was proceeding broadly as intended, this earlier tightening in financial conditions in China has contributed to the slowing in economic activity there. And yet leverage remains high, and there's still much to do there in order to ensure the soundness of the Chinese financial system. So the tensions between sustaining growth and financial stability in China remain. And while the authorities may want to help support growth of economic activity, they recognise that a broad-based easing of policy runs the risk of undoing what's already been achieved with the deleveraging to date. Another concern for China, of course, is the adverse effects of the trade tensions with the US. That dispute is weighing on Chinese economic activity and trade. And softer demand from China has weighed on growth elsewhere in Asia, and the region would be relatively exposed to a more marked slowing in China if that was to occur. So consistent with the focus of global financial markets on downside risks, price adjustments have been in the form of a rise in risk premia in equity and corporate bond markets. In the US equity markets, for instance, price declines that were seen in late 2018 were accompanied by only pretty small downgrades to analysts' expectations for earnings growth over the medium term. So prices down, but earnings expectations not down so much. Well, that implies that the willingness of investors to pay for those earnings had declined materially. In other words, the equity risk premium went up. And similarly, in corporate bond markets, future default rates expected by analysts, they hardly moved over this period. But the spreads widened sharply, reflecting an increase in credit risk premiums. And while early 2019 has seen a partial retracement of these moves, both equity and credit risk premia remain higher than a year ago. And this rise in equity and credit risk premia follows an extended period where they had been unusually low, and even uncomfortably low, particularly in the US. So some adjustment to these was inevitable and indeed welcome from the perspective of financial stability. And while these premia remain a bit higher than a year ago, they're still not that high by historical standards. So at the same time that markets became more concerned about downside risks to economic activity, they became less concerned about those upside risks to inflation. And part of that reflected the revisions to the outlook for growth. But lower oil prices have also had a significant effect on the near-term outlook for inflation, and break-even inflation expectations have shifted down accordingly. So the combination of all of these changes, the reduced expectations for growth and inflation, increased concerns about downside risks, and these higher corporate risk premiums, that's seen market participants revise down their expectations for the paths of monetary policies. And as you can see here, longer-term sovereign yields have also declined noticeably. There's a lot in this chart. Essentially, the hard lines show you where monetary policy for different different economies has been going. The dashed lines in for each country are the market expectations, and the coloured ones are the current expectations. And you can see they've tended to shift down since the market expectations at the late last year. We also can see the FOMC so-called dots, which I'll talk about in just a minute. So these changes in in expectations for monetary policy have been most pronounced in the United States. As recently as December, market pricing implied an expectation that the US Federal Reserve would increase interest rates in 2019. Indeed, this was supported by the so-called dots, which are the median of the most likely projections of each of the FOMC members. Currently, market pricing implies no increases in 2019 and even some chance of a reduction in the Fed funds rate in 2020. Once again, the repricing appears to reflect concerns over what could happen as much as what is considered most likely to happen. And one way to illustrate this is by examining the survey-based expectations of primary dealers in the US money market. And what these data show is that primary dealers are increasingly concerned about the tail risk that the Fed's Fed funds rate will return to zero in the next few years. Nevertheless, their most likely forecast remains for further rate increases. So central bank policy expectations have shifted elsewhere as well, although generally by less than in the US. And that difference is likely to have contributed to a depreciation of the US dollar after its trend appreciation last year. And here I show the nominal trade-weighted exchange rates for some of the major economies. I'll return to foreign exchange markets in just a moment, but let me briefly take stock. So the upshot of all of these recent developments is that global financial market conditions have tightened a little. The cost for corporations to raise capital through equity and debt markets has increased a bit in the advanced economies. But overall, conditions are not tight, with monetary policy rates still low and government bond yields also low. Indeed, bond yields are generally lower than they've been for a couple of years. Let me turn now then to the implications of all of this for Australia. So over recent months, developments in Australian financial markets have been similar in many respects to those offshore that I've just discussed. Equity prices fell, credit spreads rose, and so did various measures of financial market volatility. Also, although some of the more pronounced moves seen late last year have been retraced in early 2019. So these changes have again largely been a story of risk premium increasing from low levels, and they are associated with rising concerns about downside risks, both internationally and domestically. So the outlook for the domestic economy has also shifted, and the bank's revised down its forecast for both growth and inflation. Our forecasts continue, though, to project a further gradual reduction in spare capacity in the economy, with the unemployment rate trending lower. And that should see wages growth pick up, although only gradually, and inflation is also expected to increase gradually. And the bank's statement on monetary policy, the governor's recent speech, provided some pretty comprehensive updates to this picture, so I won't go over the details now. In response to this shift in international and domestic outlooks, market expectations for the next move in the cash rate have switched signs. So the markets have assessed that the next move is more likely to be down than up. And that's been reflected in lower bond yields, alongside the effect of lower oil prices on market implied inflation expectations. 2-year bond yields in Australia have tended to decline by a bit more than in many other major markets, as seen in this chart. Part of that change is somewhat mechanical, right? Because both in Japan and the euro area, policy rates are close to their lower effective bounds. This latest change in Australia's interest rate differential extends the trend decline that's been underway for 5 or more years, and that's a bit clearer in the yellow line in this chart in the bottom panel. Over the past couple of months, the Australian dollar has depreciated by about 4% on the basis of the trade-weighted index, or the TWI. And this largely reflects the effect of the appreciation of the yen and the renminbi, which collectively comprise nearly 40% of Australia's TWI. The yen appreciation may have been driven by the tendency of the Japanese investors to bring some of their funds back home during risk-off periods in global financial markets. The decline in Australian bond yields relative to other advanced economies is likely to have contributed somewhat to the modest depreciation of the Australian dollar of late. However, over much of the past 18 months or so, higher commodity prices appear to have worked to limit the extent of Australian dollar depreciation. Indeed, commodity prices have increased noticeably of late, and this largely reflects disruptions to supply, particularly of iron ore. In short, then, there are a number of forces affecting the Aussie dollar, but they've been pulling in different directions, and accordingly, the Australian dollar remains within its relatively narrow range of the past few years. So having said that, and noted that the volatility of the exchange rate's been low over recent years, I need to briefly touch on the recent flash event in currency markets that no doubt caught the attention of many of you in this room. On the 3rd of January, in the span of just a few minutes, a sharp appreciation in the yen against the US dollar quickly cascaded into the Australian dollar, which depreciated by up to 7% against the yen. At the same time, bid-ask spreads, which you can see in the lower panel here, they'd widened significantly. Trading conditions then quickly returned to normal, though, and currencies largely retracted their earlier moves. It's difficult to draw any firm conclusions on the causes of such events, but as we outlined in our recent statement on monetary policy, I think three factors are likely to have contributed. So the first of these is that there was the liquidation of carry trade positions, notably from highly leveraged Japanese retail investor accounts. These appear to have been automatically triggered following the initial appreciation of the yen. And then the second thing is that these liquidations occurred at a time when market liquidity was seasonally low, such that the foreign exchange market was more exposed to imbalances between buy and sell orders. Indeed, recent flash events have tended to occur around this same time of day, in between the close of US markets and the start of the Asian trading. It was also this time early in the new year and, in addition, a public holiday in Japan. And third, as in previous flash events, algorithmic trading strategies may have amplified the move, for example, by adding to demand to buy the yen as it appreciated. Now, it's also difficult to be very definitive about what restored orderly market functioning. Market contacts of ours suggest that discretionary buying of Aussie dollars by traditional market-making banks and institutional accounts helped to stabilise conditions and re-establish the process of price discovery. Anyway, ultimately, this event did not lead to wider disruption, but the growing list of such disorderly moves in key financial markets in recent years certainly bears close watching. So let me conclude. There have been modest revisions to the outlook for economic activity and inflation globally. Additionally, downside risks are attracting more attention from both market participants and central banks, and these changes have been accompanied by a rise in the market's assessment of risks relating to the corporate sector, albeit from relatively low levels. There's also been a reassessment of the outlook for monetary policies, and interest rates have shifted down across the yield curve. The decline in sovereign yields has worked to partially offset the effect of higher risk premiums, and so finance is still readily available to borrowers at relatively low rates. Broadly similar changes in economic and financial conditions have also occurred domestically. And while commodity prices have risen of late, Australia's terms of trade are still forecast to decline gradually over the next couple of years. So pulling all of these things together, it's not so surprising then that the Australian dollar has depreciated a little over recent months. And while the exchange rate is still within the relatively narrow range of the past few years, the recent depreciation is helpful at the margin, given that there remains spare capacity in the economy and inflation remains below target. So let me finish there and happy to take questions. I think, as Alex said, he's going to identify people and pass the mic around. So,
hi, Chris. My name's Tom. I'm from Rochford. Just a quick question on, is there a likelihood that the RBA may be patient on easing monetary policy to allow deleveraging to occur that's happening in the economy right now? So if economic conditions in Australia continue to weaken, would you potentially stand pat on monetary policy because, you know, deleveraging is happening now and needs to happen and is a positive outcome of, you know, regulatory events and things that we've seen unfold in the last couple of years?
I think the things we would look at when making decisions about monetary policy are as they've always been. So we would look at the strength of economic activity, conditions in the labour market, and inflation. Now, under the conditions you're suggesting, those are likely to be conditions under which growth is not particularly strong and maybe our unemployment rate isn't moving much lower. So that would be, as you would think, something that the bank would take account of appropriately.
Adrian's my name. So housing markets have dropped maybe 10% in Sydney and Melbourne, yet unemployment seems to be particularly low. So typically, when there's only high unemployment, house prices might decline, but it seems to be the opposite at the moment. What's the main reason for that, do you think?
I think the main reason is supply and demand in the housing market. I think we've had quite a bit of extra supply coming on, and people have noticed that. They're projecting further increases as we complete buildings that have been put in place and started some time ago. And I think they also recognise house prices were very high. So they're falling the most in Sydney and Melbourne, and that's where house prices had gone up the most, and house prices in particular versus apartment prices, which didn't go up by quite as much. So I think it's a sort of a market correction. People have reassessed what they think is a fair value, particularly in light of strong supply.
Thank you, Ken Atchison. Thank you very much. The Royal Commission on the Financial System has highlighted some problems in the banking sector, but part of the consequences seem to be a reduction in lending by the banking system. But secondarily, also there's a growth in non-bank lending in Australia. It's partly following on from the previous question about housing market. Do you see that in Australia the non-bank activity, lending activity, will increase, and are the established banks likely to play a lesser role in lending into the housing sector?
Well, it's been true for some time that the constraints earlier put on bank lending by APRA going back a few years and before the Royal Commission had contributed to some slowing, particularly of the investor loans, which they were targeting, and then the interest-only loans, which were growing very strongly. So that left room for a pickup in non-bank lending to satisfy the demand that was out there. And that's been growing very strongly. There's no doubt about that. I mean, one imagines it's likely to continue for a time. I think the thing I would point out, though, is that they account for a fairly small share of credit, in the order of about 5%. I think it's on the bank lending side, what we've seen is that, yes, it's true that lending standards have tightened even a little bit further last year, partly in response to the Royal Commission and the focus on responsible lending. But the other thing that we understand is that demand for credit has slown quite significantly, and that makes sense. Right, house prices, when they're declining, particularly investors are less willing to go out and get a loan to buy a house or an asset that they think in the next little while will become worth a little bit less than it was at the time they bought it. So I think it's important to focus as much on the demand for credit as it is to focus on the supply.
Chris, hi. My name's Matt Wilson. I was just wanting to ask you about, there's a couple of... you talked about downside risks. There's a couple potentially big ones. We've got Brexit happening, or supposedly happening very soon, and obviously an election in Australia. Whilst the RBA is most likely to sort of sit back and wait to see what happens before responding, I mean, do you have any sort of views on what you think is likely to happen in, say, a Brexit situation and how that's going to affect Australia?
I think part of the issue with Brexit is no one really knows what's going to happen, how it's going to play out. I would anticipate that barring a real disturbance to the financial system globally, the sort of real economic effects, which will be potentially substantial for the UK in particular and to a lesser extent Europe, those will have a fairly marginal effect on us, a pretty small effect, because they're not really a very large trading partner of ours. So it's the channel to be worried about, if you were to be worried at all, is through the financial system. I don't think that's really the focus. I think most of the focus is on what's going to happen to the real economy in the UK in particular. And you can see already the uncertainty that it's created is already, I think, weighing on business decisions in that economy and having an adverse effect. Thank you.
Anybody else? Damien Berry, just while we're on Europe,
The data that came out of Germany during the week around growth suggests, while not technically in recession, it's pretty close. The Italian data suggests the same. Do you see a scenario here where there's an acceleration in the deceleration of growth? So we end up with a situation where the rate of growth is declining more rapidly than central banks can keep up with?
Well, I think the problem they face and what you're alluding to is the fact that in terms of their interest rates, they're already at the effective lower bound, so they can't do more there. As you know, they've stopped recently their program of quantitative easing. They've put that on hold, so I'm not going to really speculate about what they might do on that front. It is true that that means monetary policy has a bit less capacity to stimulate the economy, but I mean, we'll have to wait and see. I think part of what's happening in Europe is some of the weakness there of late, and I emphasise the some, not all. It's partly related to, I think, what's happening in China and the Chinese consumer being a bit weaker than there has been in the past. And, of course, Europe's a trading nation and trades heavily with China. So that's part of the story. But yes, monetary policy has some sort of limited firepower there in Germany, for sure, in Europe, for sure.
John from ICSI. Looking at what would it take for the RBA to move to a tightening bias, and how much does the local property market feature in that decision?
I think I'll answer that by just talking more about what it is, coming back, I think, to this point before, the sort of things we care about. I mean, where we're at the moment is we have seen a pretty strong labour market, stronger than expected, that's for sure, of late. Unemployment rates trending down, that's welcome. But wage growth, while it's picking up, is only picking up gradually. And that's we need to see more of that in order to help move inflation back towards the target. So those are sort of the things that are concerning us. So things that delay that process would make would increase the chances of no change in policy for some time. Now, the housing market, we don't directly target the housing market. We certainly don't target housing prices. We don't target credit. What we do think about, though, is the implications of housing market developments for the economy. And one mechanism of that is very direct through building, and another is it may have some adverse effects on the consumer's willingness to consume if there are adverse wealth effects. As my colleague Alex Heath the other day suggested, we think those do exist, but they're fairly modest in the scheme of things, and probably the more important thing for consumption to focus on is income growth rather than sort of house prices.
There's obviously quite a strong focus on the unemployment rate, but if you look at the numbers that came out in the last 2 months, you've had full-time employment drop in both the last 2 months, and the actual lowering of the unemployment rate has been because part-time jobs have jumped quite significantly. So I guess there's talk of the underemployment rate being closer to 8%. How do you, balance that? You know, it does sound like the overall unemployment rate is low, but then it does seem like there's underemployment in Australia.
It's certainly true that there is underemployment, and we've spent quite a bit of time looking at the various measures. I think what that tells us is that while you're right, the whatever measure you use, underemployment is there, but it doesn't really tell a very different picture from what the unemployment rate is doing. So while the unemployment rate's been trending down, so has underemployment. You talked about the full-time, sort of part-time split. I mean, this data's pretty volatile from 1 month to the next, so it bears watching, but I wouldn't read too much into sort of the monthly wiggles in the data from the labour market.
Hi, Hi, Richard Cummell. Sorry, could I just circle back to those comments you made regarding consumer consumption? I mean, can you just explain why the RBA is so relaxed about a negative wealth effect on consumers? I mean, if you look globally, whether it was GFC or that whole subprime property-induced downturn or other parts of the world that have had property downturn, normally the negative wealth effect is quite severe in terms of consumption.
Yeah, I think, in the context of the GFC and some of the economies you're alluding to, the circumstances that led to a real pullback in consumption were much higher unemployment, driven in part, amongst other things, by the stress in the financial system. The financial systems there were under a great degree of stress. And they had really overbuilt, I suspect, and so they had a massive stock in housing and a big overhang. So I think they were quite different circumstances. I wouldn't say we're sanguine about the wealth effect. I think it's just we reflect on the evidence and find it hard to see strong evidence of the wealth effect on the way up, and therefore that might at least cause you to question how strong it will be on the way down as house prices fall. I think the other thing to reflect on is through this housing boom, households have injected a lot of equity, and that's quite different from the earlier boom in the 2000s, where the opposite was true. So I think those things just give you pause for thought and suggest maybe it might not be too large, but it could be a factor at play, and we are concerned, and we've talked about our concerns regarding consumption, and high levels of household debt are part of that.
Thank you again, Ken Atchison. Thank you, Chris. Another question. The Australian economy has gone through without any recession for, I think it's 27 years now. Is the business cycle, as we know it in history, finished, or are there policy reasons why Australia has had that experience, and is it likely to continue?
I think I would. That's an issue, I think, which the perspective's very much focused on GDP and quarterly movements in GDP. I think the thing I prefer to focus on is a sort of a broader sense of how well the economy's doing. And I would say that, well, yes, on some metrics we haven't had a recession, but we did have periods where the unemployment rate went up noticeably, and I think that's the sort of thing that we should be as focused on as much. It didn't go up by nearly as much as it has, say, in the early 90s recession. I think that's the thing to focus on. If you are going to have periods of weakness, hopefully they can be fairly short-lived and not too extreme in terms of things like higher unemployment. I think part of it was a good policy framework, a strong banking system, a flexible exchange rate helped. I think monetary policy at the margin made a good contribution, particularly by its earlier efforts to keep inflation low and stable. I think we've got a fair amount of flexibility through the economy, including in the labour market, and I think all of that's helped. So hopefully those things stand us in good stead for whatever will come our way. But no, I don't think the business cycle is dead.
Martin from SE. Chris, you made a comment earlier that the RBA was very comfortable with the recent decline in the Australian dollar. With importers and exporters in the room, is there a position or a further decline that you'd continue to be comfortable in, or a ballpark whereby you'd be happy for it to land?
Oh, well, maybe you were still eating your breakfast when I, in my sort of second paragraph of my speech, said we're not in the business of forecasting the Aussie dollar, so I won't forecast the Aussie dollar for you. I don't think if I tried, it wouldn't be very good, which is why I'm not going to try. I think the important thing to recognise is, look, very much when it comes to the exchange rate and questions about where it's moving and what that implies for the economy, you have to ask very much about what's causing it to move. So if it was to move lower because of adverse circumstances, as it might do in, say, the global economy, major trading partners or commodity prices falling, well, it's playing a stabilising role, and that's a helpful role to play, but those aren't conditions where the economy's going to particularly be strong. It's not to say under such circumstances a move in the exchange rate wouldn't be welcome. It would. So I think that's what you have to do. You have to step back and say, well, what are the circumstances you're talking about that would lead to a movement in the exchange rate? And generally, over time, it plays a helpful stabilising role.
Just have a couple more questions.
Chris, I'm just talking more broadly about the US dollar. So there's a lot of discussion that, particularly within the US, that they want to see a weaker US dollar. But there is a perception that the declining rate of growth globally will sustain a high US dollar for longer because there's no other alternative currency that can seek to compete with the US to see its depreciation. Do you have any views on the US dollar?
Well, I think the story you're telling there is probably a reasonable story for much of 2018 when we saw the US dollar appreciate. And that was happening because the Federal Reserve Bank was raising rates. They were doing that because their labour market was very tight. Their inflation was already at target. They were wanting to, if anything, slow the growth impetus and certainly the contribution from what had been very low interest rates for some time. So, and that was happening when, as you say, in, say, Europe, in Japan, they're really struggling to generate the inflation they would like to generate, even though their economies were also experiencing tightening labour markets, just not to the same extent as the US. So, yeah, I think that's an environment where the US dollar appreciates, and we saw that. What we saw very recently, and as I picked up in my speech, is when market expectations for the Fed funds rate came back and even suggested that we might get a fall in interest rates a bit further out in the US, then the US dollar turned a little bit. And I think that broadly makes sense. Finish on that.
All right. I'm very aware of the fact that you've got a flight to catch, Chris. So just on behalf of everybody here, I think it's very informative. Thank you very much, Chris. And look forward to seeing you again.
Thanks very much. And thank you. Thank you for your time this morning and your excellent questions. Much appreciated.
Cool. Thanks, mate. Cheers.